You are listening to the Next Best Picture podcast, and this is Daniel Howitt's interview with the composer for Candyman, Robert Ikey Aubrey Lowe.
Candyman. The urban legend is, if you say his name five times while looking in the mirror, he appears in the reflection and kills you.
Who would do that?
Candyman. 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 Candyman.
Well, we're still alive.
Let's go. Trina, you broke the door. This isn't funny!
I feel really connected to this neighborhood. Cabrini Green. It was a project. I just moved in around the corner.
The old candy factory.
I'm an artist.
You look up a candy man. He's the monster that's part of this neighborhood.
Why are you drawn to this?
I'm hoping to spread the story all about Candyman. The mirror invites you to summon him. You should say his name. I dare you.
Candyman.
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 Don't say that.
Candyman.
I think I made a mistake. I brought him back.
Candyman isn't real!
Something's happening to me.
He had a purpose for you. To be another one of his terrible stories.
I guess he found me. I am the writing on the wall. The sweet smell of blood.
Your score for Candyman. I'm excited to dive in.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So I understand that you used to live just four blocks from Cabrini Green, where Candyman takes place. Is that a coincidence, or were you brought on? Is that part of a reason that you were brought onto this project?
No, they were unaware that I lived. And I always say four blocks, but it was like 4 to 6 blocks. But in the vicinity, I lived very close to the housing project. Wow. No, Monkey Paw and Nia had no idea that I don't even remember if they were aware that I lived in Chicago, initially, but anyhow, just happenstance. Wow. that happened to be the case.
Yeah. And then how did that impact? Obviously you knew that when you were brought on. So how did that, impact your excitement for the project, or the way you kind of envisioned what your score for this might be in those early stages?
I think, you know, due to the fact that I did have a relationship with the city and understood Cabrini Green, and also even growing up, you know, watching television, a show like Good Times was set in Cabrini Green. So, you know, there was already a sort of relationship there as far as my own makeup and the relationship to the city itself. I was also very excited due to the fact that I was such a big fan of the original film by Bernard Rose. And also, you know, was a huge fan of Clive Barker's work at the time, and I still am. So I don't know, I guess it was very exciting for me to sort of investigate what that meant, and sort of surveying that particular psychic energy But yeah, I don't know if that answers your question.
No, that's great. That's great. Well, tell me about those early conversations. Tell me about working with Nia DaCosta. You know, what were those first conversations like as she described what she was looking for in the score for Candyman and how you guys worked together?
I think, you know, I was approached by the production to see if I had an interest in doing the film because they were familiar with my work. So I think out of the gate, they already had an inkling of what they wanted to do to my existing body of work. So the conversations that we had were really about tone. There were conversations back and forth about the legacy of the film, about the legacy of the original score by Philip Glass. And so one thing for me that I really wanted to try to stay away from was to make too many overt references to the original score. One thing for me is with when you are investigating an idea that has already existed in the world, but coming at it from a different perspective, I think it should obviously be able to stand on its own as an individual work. So I wanted to make sure that I didn't lean too heavily into what had existed before due to the fact that I thought that I would be able to bring not only my own voice to this project and to be able to build a world that existed within the universe of the story while sort of casting out this, sound that was not necessarily maybe tangentially related to the original and had nods to it, but really existed within my own voice as my own work.
And you've talked a lot about playing with illusion, mm-hmm. And even the idea of like mirrors for this score. So tell me more about how you describe the sound that you wanted to create for Candyman, and you know, what feelings you wanted to evoke.
Well, so there were a number of intentions that I brought to the table initially, after I had really sat down, read the script, had conversations with Nia and Ian Cooper, the producer on the film, about what it was I wanted to be able to bring to the project. And that was one, of course, investigating the original film and the legacy of the film itself and the score. Clive Barker's larger cinematic universe, because I think it does tie in. To be able to play with sound in a way that made things uneasy or almost, you know, at times I would describe it as almost a seasickness. I wanted to be able to play with sound in a way in which I could excite the ear, even just in a stereo field, not even in a surround field, to be able to sort of compact it into a stereo field in which the ear was excited by these psychoacoustic events, being able to use electronics and synthesizers as well as acoustic instruments and play with what that meant sonically and to be able to create a sonic palette in which I was able to trick one's ear and in a way that they wouldn't be able to discern, oh, well, that's definitely a cello, or that's definitely a synthesizer, or that's definitely a voice. I really wanted to play around with a lot of that. Voice was also something that was very big in the context of the score, not only the conversations that Nia and I had had about the multiplicity of voices and the stories throughout the folklore that was attached to the film. But, you know, the voice is my first instrument, and I really like, it's such an interesting and unique and malleable instrument. I wanted to be able to play around with the human voice and make it into something that you wouldn't be able to discern necessarily as that thing. And so then again, you have this push and pull with reality and fantasy and what is happening in real time and what is happening in a dream state or a hypnagogic state, you know? So I that's something that it was really important to me to be able to play around with.
Greetings from Evergreen Podcasts. We're rolling out a listener survey and we want to hear from you. The information in the survey will help us gather statistics and in turn make our shows more appealing to advertisers. I know most people don't like ads, but this is one of the only ways our shows make money and help keep their lights on. We promise it will only take a few minutes, but the impact on our podcasts will be tremendous. As a token of our appreciation, we'll randomly select one lucky participant each month to win an exclusive merchandise package from Evergreen Podcasts. Head to evergreenpodcast.com/listener survey to help a show and possibly get some free stuff for doing so. We can't thank you enough for the support. Now back to the show.
I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of Burn the Boats from Evergreen Podcasts. I interview political leaders and influencers, folks like award-winning journalist Soledad O'Brien and conservative columnist Bill Kristol, about the choices they confront when failure is not an option. I won't agree with everyone I talk to, but I respect anyone who believes in something enough to risk everything for it. Because history belongs to those willing to burn the boats. Episodes are out every other week wherever you get your podcasts.
As you're playing around or as you're approaching creating the tracks, where do you begin? With a lot of film scores, you have traditional strings and clearly defined melodies, mm-hmm. and things like that. But I understand that you were recording sound effects and vocalizations on set as well. Mm-hmm. So where do you kind of begin to merge this all together?
Well, the field recordings that I did on set, that was another intention that I had brought to the table very early on, because I wanted to be able to capture the sound of the actual locations or people on those locations and manipulate those in a way that I could make them into textural elements that would live within the body of the score, and those textural elements are also carrying through the psychic energy of the actual space. So thinking about things in a very three-dimensional way, I wanted to, really be able to create that world. And inside of that concept of world building, I really wanted to have things that really happened in real time in those spaces, and then be able to manipulate those and then give them a new life and a new energy.
As you're approaching those field recordings, how much did you know of what you wanted, or was it really discovering that when you showed up?
I was really about taking in as much as I could and then surveying that and making informed decisions on what particular sounds I wanted to use, or if there were any sort of tonalities or textures inside of those sounds, and then be able to stretch and manipulate those things. I have a very aleatoric process, and so I really like to involve chance in the way that I compose, because that also gives me a window into being able to consider things that I may not have initially considered, which I think ultimately can make for a stronger work and a more complex landscape.
because your work does so blend sound design with music as well, how much collaboration did you have with the sound team on the film, especially when it comes to like mixing the final film? Was there any collaboration there?
There were conversations that I had with the sound mixer, and we had some really nice conversations about, you know, what it all meant, and I really wanted to be able to provide him with enough material that in the case of any sort of sound design, like basically, you know, when I talk about world building or like creating these landscapes, it's about creating a language which takes time. And so the fact that I started working on ideas off of conversations and reading the script before anything had been shot, before location scouting was done, before casting was finished, it was an allowance for me to be able to provide sonic information that Nia could have in her ear as she was shooting the film. And then vice versa, I was really keen to be on location because I wanted to be witness to how she directed, how she was moving in real time. And so one informed the other, and it's all about this idea of a true collaboration, you know. And I wanted to be able to provide the most complex and most expanded sonic landscape that could itself be a character within the landscape of the film for her, and to make sure that her vision was, I was able to help carry her vision through to the finish line.
You've spoken before about how you love to keep making and tweaking and playing around with your work. I wrote a quote from you. I really like the idea of a work in progress. But obviously at a certain point, the film's got to be printed, you know, it's got to be finalized. How do you know when to step away and be done?
I think, you know, I do like to play around with things, and I do like to take time with things, but I also understand that things are not perfect. And so I don't strive for that perfection. It's not something that I'm chasing. Generally, the first idea is the freshest and most interesting. So I try to keep it as close to the start as I can, but things will change in an edit. Things will change through conversation. And in that moment, it's interesting for me because it does give me time to reconsider the things that I've done and say, okay, well, I was coming at it from this perspective and I was thinking about it in this way, but now that I've had a conversation with Nia or with any director, they know what my position is and what the context is for what I'm providing, and then they are giving me the context for what they are looking to find. And so you sort of meet in the middle, or maybe the first time out is the most interesting thing. And then, you know, you go through something, you work it through. It turns out that it was best the way that it was. And it's really about playing around with things. And I guess I know it's done when it's done because I can trust my intuition. And that's something that I think is really important, being able to trust one's own intuition and know when something is good and when something is right or when something is overworked, you know?
That's really good. You've done plenty of work on films and on scores, but this is one of your first credits as a solo composer. And you've just been shortlisted for an Academy Award. Yeah. How does it feel to be recognized in that way?
I mean, I think it's nice. It's not something that I was expecting. I am more than happy that the response to this particular score has been what it's been. It's not a conventional score. It's not arrived at in any sort of a conventional way. And I like that fact that people are compelled to really look at what it is and how it got to be where it was, which, you know, is hopeful for me, you know, because conventional film scoring, there's nothing wrong with it necessarily. But for me, it's always more interesting to be able to push the boat out and try new things and expand my own vernacular and you know, try to create new vocabularies, because it's an artistic process. So why would you not want to do that?
That's great. Well, I mean, I was also going to ask you, I'm always interested to hear from professionals in the industry, you know, any peers that you have been impressed by. Are there modern film scores or composers that you've been really taken by? Maybe some favorite scores from the last year?
Actually, so the score for the film Censor by Prana Bailey Bond, the composer Emily Levinas-Ferrouche, her score for Censor was really fantastic. That was a big one for me that I really, really enjoyed. Mika Levy's score for Zola, I think is really great. Gosh, I'm trying to think. I've been so bogged down with work on this end that I haven't been able to really pay a ton of attention to scores, nor have I seen a ton of film. Oh, actually, Natalie Holt's score for the television series Loki was fantastic. It was so good. And there were like little funny things in there, like these Wagnerian nods, which, you know, sort of ties into this, the mythology, which I thought was really funny. That one was an excellent score. There was a lot that I heard. What was the one? Maybe it was Clint Mansell's score for In the Earth. That one I liked. I can't believe I'm forgetting this. Aiko Ishibashi's score for Drive My Car. It's a beautiful score. Aiko Ishibashi was one of my favorites.
Yeah, so good. So good. Well, Robert, I appreciate your time. Appreciate your work. I appreciate just you bringing a unique voice to this world of film composing. You know, we don't often hear unique work like this. So I just really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. That's really nice. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Well, I'll let you go. Congrats on your, you've got an upcoming Sundance premiere. So best of luck.
Thank you so much. Yeah, it's a really great film by a new filmmaker, Mariama Diallo. It's awesome.
Very excited to see it. Well, best of luck with that premiere.
Thanks. Take care.
Hey, everyone. Thank you so much for listening to Daniel Howitt's interview with the composer for Candyman, Robert Ike Aubrey Lowe, here on the Next Best Picture podcast. Candyman is currently shortlisted for Best Original Score at this year's Academy Awards and is available for your consideration of other categories as well. You have been listening to the Next Best Picture podcast. We are proud to be part of the Evergreen Podcast Network, and you can subscribe to us anywhere where you subscribe to podcasts. Be sure to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and let us know what you think of the show. We really appreciate your feedback and your support, which you can also lend on over at Patreon. For $1 minimum a month, you will get some exclusive podcast content from us. Thank you so much for listening, as always, and we shall see you all next time.
I'm a grown-up.
Me too.
Yep, me too. But you know, these days, being a grown-up can really suck.
Luckily, we're grown-ups who grew up in the coolest generation.
We had video arcades.
And also some of the best TV and movies ever made.
We lived the origin of awesome consumer electronics. The list goes on and on.
Yep, Generation X.
Exactly.
And we're Gen X grown-up.
Every week, the Gen X grown-up podcast explores media, tech, toys, games, and more from both yesterday and today.
Through the eyes of Generation Xers who absolutely love that stuff. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
Or find us on our website, GenXGrownUp.com. Life sucks as a grown-up. All right, you think that was good enough?
I hope so, man. I'm tired.
Who listens to a promo on a podcast and then goes and listens to a different podcast?
Right.
I've never done it. No. Right.